51 right now in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. My guest, Justine Cowan, is a well-known environmental attorney who is probably best known for uncovering wrongdoing that forced the resignation of one of the members of the cabinet of President Donald Trump. But what we're focusing on today is Justine Cowan's first book, an intensely personal memoir, titled The Secret Life of Dorothy Soames. Dorothy Soames was Justine's mother. And the two of them had a very difficult relationship. Dorothy was not an affectionate or positive mother in any way, and yet was rigidly controlling. And ultimately, Justine, out of a sense of self-preservation, had to distance herself considerably from her mother. It was only when her mother first entered the early stages of Alzheimer's that Justine learned for the first time that what Dorothy had always said about her background, her childhood, was wrong, and that, in fact, Dorothy had been raised at London's infamous Foundling Hospital. And this set Justine on a passage of discovery to learn as much as she could about that and about her mother's mother. And what she uncovered really helped answer a lot of questions about why Dorothy was the person and the mother that she was. And it's also an illuminating look at the Foundling Hospital and the way in which they treated the young children who were entrusted in its care. The book, again, is titled The Secret Life of Dorothy Soames, a memoir published by Harper, the author, Justine Cowan.
When I first sat down to write the book, I planned to only write about my mother's story, and I naively thought that would be straightforward. But soon I was really brought into the story and the research that I did, and found that it couldn't be told without telling the impact that my mother's childhood had on me. And it was very emotional. I'm an attorney and litigated for years, and showing emotion is not necessarily my strong point. But I found every day that going through this experience really chipped away at my exterior and allowed me to have this just really incredible journey where I learned to understand my mother, my grandmother, myself, and countless other people who have a parent who was somehow damaged in the past and cannot parent to the next generation, and what that experience is like.
I think it's important for us, in setting the context for what we will ultimately learn about your mother, to first get a sense of what your childhood was like and what she was like as a mother. Let's begin there.
Well, on the outside, our lives were idyllic. We lived in a wealthy suburb of San Francisco, and my mother was just charming. And she dressed impeccably, and she had a beautiful British accent, and our house was beautiful, and everything looked wonderful from the outside. But inside our home, I mean, my mother could have inexplicable rages, highly critical, but the worst part of it was that there was just a disconnect. There was no bond between me and my mother, and it was lonely to be raised in our house. I had a very loving father, but the relationship between my mother just got worse over the years, and I grew to despise her. And I carried with me this extreme anger towards her that I carried throughout my life.
You write very early in the book, I had spent a lifetime loathing my mother, many thousands of miles away to be rid of her, only to be haunted by her after she was gone. And of course, that's a abiding theme in this story. One of the things about your childhood, and we'll eventually explore this again, but it's important for our listeners to understand that your childhood, despite this emotional coldness from your mother, was also filled to the brim, really to excess, with all kinds of activities and lessons and so on. I mean, a dizzying array of activities. Describe what I'm talking about.
Oh, well, I mean, it started in the morning. We'd probably go to my violin lessons. I remember driving through the streets with my mother, and no one was awake yet because she wanted me to have violin lessons with this wonderful professor who taught music in San Francisco, who could only see me that early in the morning. And I had horseback riding lessons, dance lessons, and ballet lessons, and I mean, all sorts of lessons. And I even had handwriting lessons. I had a private handwriting tutor. I've yet to meet anyone who has had that kind of lesson. And I will say it didn't work out very well because my handwriting is illegible. But my mother certainly tried to get me to have handwriting that was as beautiful as hers.
You write at one point, she was relentless in her goal to mold me into an accomplished and refined young lady. Explain to our listeners the kind of distance that you ultimately felt you had to create between you and your mother. I mean, there was already this kind of emotional gulf, but at some point you determined that for your own well-being and or sanity, you needed to, in a sense, physically distance yourself from your mother. And you did so in fairly dramatic fashion. Explain.
Well, it really started, I lived overseas for a year. I did something that lots of young 20-somethings did, is I taught English. And during that year, I was completely separate from my family. You know, this was way back when you couldn't, just use social media and texting and all of that. To stay in touch, and my phone didn't even accept international calls, and I relished in it, and I loved that independence. And when I came home, I went to Washington, D.C., and then every year, I would go home. And for example, I'd go home for Christmas, and it really would start in the fall where I would start to get this heavy weight, dreading going home, weeks and weeks before I would go home. And it was just this depression that weighted me down. And, I realized that the source of it was going home. And so over time, I stopped going home for Christmas. And then I would I built a fortress around myself where I was still in touch. We never were estranged. But I would talk to her once a week. I would limit my visits. I had a 3-day limit for any visits. After a while, I wouldn't let her stay in my house, mostly because if I went off to work, I would come back and she had rearranged my house and all sorts of crazy things. So, as I got more distance, I was able to develop the rest of my life, and I felt my depression slowly melt away.
So you decided at some point that it was clear that, in a sense, the farther you were from your mother, I think you say at one point, your happiness increased exponentially. I mean, in relationship to the miles between you and your mother. And yet it's interesting that at some point in the book, as you are kind of describing the state of affairs between you and your mother, I can't remember now, but you say something to the effect that we weren't exactly estranged, or, I mean, you are careful to have us understand exactly what this relationship was. And I think you say something sort of like that, that you were not estranged in the way that some parents with their adult children might be. Do you remember that moment, or what is it about that relationship in which we might jump to the wrong conclusion about what your feelings were about each other?
Well, I went through the motions. I would have a call with her once a week. I would ask her how her day was, that sort of thing. I would go visit from time to time. We would go out to dinner, whatever it may be. I always kept a distance from her. And there was no way that she could mistake it. I mean, she knew that I was keeping my distance, and I knew that it broke her heart. But it felt like survival to me. I mean, if my mother would reach out to hold me, you know, hug me, I mean, recoil, it felt some sort of, you know, it felt dangerous. And, you know, it was something that I didn't always understand. And because my mother never hit me, or anything like that. And, you know, I, of course, have lists of things that she did that were not particularly good parenting, but it never reached the limit where I could really understand why it was that there was this chasm between us.
So the cords were never entirely broken the way, of course, it sometimes happens in families, and yet what was right there was very, very cool and distant. Throughout your childhood and I suppose into your adulthood as well, describe your understanding of who your mother was and where she had come from.
Well, I was always told that she was of blue blood or royal blood, and that there was some, you know, that her past was aristocratic, and that, but also that she was illegitimate. And I don't remember ever learning that information. It was just something that I always knew. But that was it. I didn't know anything else, and I knew that she was from England, of course. But any attempts to ask questions about who my grandparents were or where she was from would always be met with anger, or she would leave the conversation. And so I learned at an early age not to ask. Her background was just a bit of a mystery. Little things would drip out from time to time, but I never even knew my grandparents' names or whether or not they were alive or dead.
Describe the moment in your life when your mother, in a sense, reached out to you and gave the first significant clue to you that the origins of her life were not at all as had been described to you.
Well, it was probably when I was 19 years old and I was in college, and my father called me and he said, "You have to come home and take care of your mother." And I was going to Berkeley at the time, and they were just across the Bay Bridge. And my dad said that she had been driving wildly through the streets, trying to go to the hospital, but she wasn't ill, and he didn't provide any explanation, but just said, "You have to come home." And so I did, and I remember walking down the hall, and the house was quiet, and my mother was sitting alone in the dark in her bedroom, and she had a notepad in her hand, and she was writing over and over and over again, so much so that there was indents in the paper. A name that I'd never heard before, and that name was Dorothy Soane. And it would be many years before I discovered the true story of Dorothy Soane, but that was the first day that I had a significant clue.
We're speaking with Justine Cowan, and we are talking about her remarkable book called The Secret Life of Dorothy Soames. So this gives you a very good hint of something unknown about your mother's past. We should probably mention that some years earlier, your mother had handed to you an interesting sort of packet or document that she very, very much wanted you to see. Explain what this was and explain what you did with it, at least in the short term.
Sure. So, you know, when I went away to college, I'd heard this name Dorothy Soames, and we didn't discuss it again. And then it wasn't for several years later that a package showed up at my house, and it was from my mother. And I opened it up, and inside it was a memoir of sorts. She had written down her story and what had happened to her as a child. And at that point in my life, I was really happy. I was developing my own life. And there had been too many secrets in our past. And I had wanted to know, as a child, who my grandparents were and all sorts of things like that. And to me, it felt sudden and perhaps even manipulative. And so I took those pages and put them back in the envelope and stuck them in the back of a file cabinet. And I must have known that one day I would want to read it, because I always saved it and I always knew where it was. But it wouldn't be until after my mother's death that I would open that envelope again.
Hmm. So at some point, your mother uses the word foundling to describe herself. I don't remember now just what the nature of that conversation was, but it was, needless to say, kind of a cryptic reference that did not make immediate sense to you. Explain that moment and the odyssey which it ultimately set in motion.
Certainly. She had, a little bit before she had sent me her memoir, she had said that she was a foundling. And that was not a word that I had ever heard before. But it stuck in my mind, and it wouldn't be until after her death that I really just went onto the internet and typed in foundling and London, and then there it was, London's Foundling Hospital, and there was a contact me section, and I did that. It's actually, the Foundling Hospital doesn't exist anymore, but there's an institution called Quorum that is the successor organization. And I reached out and I said, I'm looking for Dorothy Soames. And that was the real beginning of me digging in and finding out everything about my mother's past.
Hmm. And discovering ultimately that, yes, indeed, your mother had been a so-called foundling at this foundling hospital. Let's talk for a couple of minutes about this institution, perhaps we should call it, and a bit about its history. Again, its full name, the Hospital for the Maintenance and Education of Exposed and Deserted Young Children, but known in short as the Foundling Hospital, founded in 1739 by one Thomas Quorum. First of all, maybe give us a sense of kind of the historical backdrop of what, in a sense, society was like at this point in time, where such a place would be necessary, would serve an important function.
At the time in London, in the mid-1700s, there was nothing worse than having an illegitimate child. And it would disgrace a woman. And so on the streets of London, they would actually throw their babies on the street to die. Or they would just, these children would be left for, if they survived, for a life of theft and beggary. And there was a man named Thomas Coram who wanted to save these children. And it was, the prejudice against illegitimate children was so deep that no one wanted to help them, and likely thought they were better off dead. So he devised a plan, and he changed his pitch. And his, it wasn't necessarily just about saving these children, but creating a workforce of sorts, that these illegitimate children would be put in this institution and trained to become domestic servants and soldiers to serve Britain. And so the with the royal charter from King George II, the Foundling Hospital began taking in illegitimate children and training them to serve England.
It was interesting that at some point, maybe towards the very beginning, there was yet another purpose. I mean, if the sort of primary purpose was to give a safe haven for illegitimate children who might otherwise perish under terrible circumstances, there was a secondary purpose which involved these women giving birth to these illegitimate children and, in a sense, transforming or at least creating the potential for their lives to be transformed and redeemed. Tell us more about this other purpose of the Foundling Hospital.
Well, the second purpose was to save women from disgrace and prostitution. So if a woman was so disgraced because she had an illegitimate child, she might be kicked out of her home, kicked out of society, and might have to turn to, you know, prostitution to survive, or begging, or whatever it may be. And so it was also hoped that by giving up her child, and the child would be kept very secret. That's what the names were changed, and the identity of these children were kept secret, and then the woman could return to society and go on with her life. And the only thing that she would have to do is give up her child and never mention the child again. And that is what happened to my grandmother. And when I did my research and I went to London, I was able to see the files. And when my grandmother, her name was Lena, came to the Foundling Hospital and asked for them to take her child. She had been kicked out by her brother because she had become pregnant outside of wedlock. And because the purpose was so integral, returning a woman to her station in life, they wanted to make sure that it was possible that a woman could be returned to her station in life. And so my grandmother, as thousands of other women, had to go through an exacting interview process, an evaluation process that lasted for weeks, where they would interview the woman, and she would have to go before a panel of men who would ask her questions to make sure that, you know, this was just a momentary slip. They would interview the men in her life. In my grandmother's case, they interviewed her doctor, her brother, and her pastor, and there's letters in the files where they opined on whether or not she was a virtuous woman and could be returned to virtue if the child was given up. It was really quite astonishing, and as time went on, it almost appeared that they cared more about whether or not the woman was virtuous than whether or not they could save a small child.
Hmm. One of the things that is probably important for us to understand, it's kind of astonishing to think about, is that one of the reasons why there was this exacting process of who would be admitted, what foundlings would be admitted to the Foundling Hospital, is because there were so many of them. And one of the most fascinating passages in your book is when you describe some of the early efforts of this newly formed Foundling Hospital to sort of figure out how to do this without being inundated. Can you just describe a little bit about some of their early efforts to kind of sort out how to do this, just in terms of who to ultimately let in the door, let into the Foundling Hospital in the first place?
Well, at first, I mean, there were so many women that would come to give up their child. And it sounds callous, but these women were frequently left with no choice. And there would be a lottery system of sorts where they would pick a ball out of a pouch. And if they got the white ball, then the child would be admitted. And if it was the black ball, they would not. And fights would actually break out at the Foundling Hospital as women tried to get them to take their child. And Britain's elite would sometimes come and watch the process as a form of entertainment, as they watched this heartbreaking scene of women forced to give up their children.
Hmm. You tell us that at one point a lottery system was developed that was discarded, and then something called the general reception, which I think is part of what you're describing, in which there was this massive influx. I mean, we just can't even imagine such a scene. And eventually then this rigorous process of admission was created, and you've already described to some extent what that particular process was like. Tell us about the experience of traveling to the Foundling Hospital, or what exists today, and of being handed that folder that was the folder for your mother. And it was a thick folder with a lot of things to look through. Just explain what was in that folder and the kind of things that you were searching through in order to make sense of this.
When I first contacted what is now called Corum, they said that there were typically just small files that just confirmed whether or not a particular child was at the Foundling Hospital. And so when I arrived and saw this thick file, of course, I was quite surprised. And what I found in there, in addition to the application and the rigorous process that my grandmother went through and the various letters of saying that she was virtuous, were dozens and dozens of letters, all penned by my grandmother on various different pieces of paper, as if she took whatever paper she could get, asking about her daughter, my mother, month after month, year after year. And she would frequently ask to see her child. And when war broke out, World War II, she begged to have her child back. Also in the file were these letters that were so starkly different, all written very rigidly on a typed, typed, very brief, responding to each of those letters saying, "No, you may not see your child. We told this to you when you left her here. No, you cannot have your child back. We're going to take good care of her." And, month after month, year after year, her hopes of getting her child back or even getting a glimpse were denied.
It is hard to imagine. It is hard to imagine this scenario. It is really difficult, just kind of emotionally, to take it in. One of the things I really appreciate about your book is first of all, although there is a limit to what we can know about your grandmother, Lena Weston, you tell us whatever there is that we do know, and you also create a very important historical backdrop, which might at least in part explain how your grandmother found herself into this situation of becoming an unwed mother. You describe her as part of a lost generation of women consigned to a solitary existence. And that has something to do with world events and catastrophic world events and their impact on the general population. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about, what you are describing in this part of the book.
Well, it was the interwar period between World War One and World War II. There was untold casualties during World War One, and which left behind, you know, a generation of young women who there were not as many men to marry, unfortunately. And at the time, a man, if he sought comfort in the arms of a woman, he would be, he was sowing his wild oats or whatever it might be. But for a woman, you know, to seek any comfort would be disgraceful. And, but with no one to marry, you know, sometimes these things happened. And then at the time, of course, there was no birth control of any sort. There was just the beginning of efforts to bring certain birth control to women, but it was limited to married women. And then if a woman got pregnant, even it was in the law that she would be considered an imbecile. She was considered deficient, and she could be institutionalized. It was considered a mental illness for a woman to get pregnant outside of marriage. Of course, the man did not suffer really any repercussions whatsoever.
Right. You write at one point, society was not kind to women like Lena. And I think you do such a good job of describing the kind of the day-to-day existence for somebody like Lena at this point in time, writing, with only the steady rhythm of daily chores and Sunday sermons to fill the solitude of her days, her chance at finding intimacy, tenderness, and love would have been few to non-existent. So little wonder that that she would find herself in this situation. And then, of course, what is so heartbreaking is that the really the only viable option left to her was for her child to be given over to this foundling hospital, which does ultimately take her in. What you do from there is describe the kind of care that was given to these foundlings, including the process by which they would actually be taken out in the countryside in foster care, only to be returned back to the institution when they were five. At a glance, that might seem like a perfectly fine scenario, but you help us understand, in a sense, what a cruel scenario, in fact, this was. Explain.
Well, it was a system that was initially created because in the 1700s and 1800s, when the children would come to the foundling hospital, many of them died. And so they created a system where they would be nursed in the countryside. And then at the age of five, they would be returned to the institution. And frequently, these children that were placed in these foster families of a sort didn't even know that they were foundlings. They didn't know that their foster parents weren't their own, that their siblings that they might have been playing alongside were not their siblings. And it varied. Some of these foster parents were loving and some were not. My mother, her foster parents were not loving. But it didn't matter, because at the age of five, no matter what, the child would be taken with no explanation and no warning, placed on a bus, and taken to the foundling hospital. And, there's one story that I uncovered where a boy was picking flowers by the roadside outside of his foster home, and he was told to get on a bus, and no change of clothes, nothing, and he got on the bus, and that was the last time he saw his foster family. And when they show up, they're treated like prisoners. They're herded in like cattle. Their heads are shorn. They are stripped of their clothes. They're scrubbed and put in these tubs, several at a time, and scrubbed, and not told anything about what is happening to them, whether they will see their foster parents ever again, and many times they would never see them again, and then placed in this institutional setting. And on the very first night my mother was there, she was told by this very gruff woman, no one should make a sound, but if you need to use a chamber pot, let me know. And my mother cried out in the night and said she needed to use a chamber pot, and more because she was afraid than anything else. And she was unable to use the chamber pot, and that made the woman very upset, and she punched my mother, little five-year-old girl, in the abdomen because she couldn't urinate. And it was, that was her introduction to the Foundling Hospital, and that was not the worst day that she experienced.
Right. But it does give us some sense of how what kind of a place this was. And interestingly, her foster mother, who had your mother for several years before she was brought back, who was not a kind, loving person at all. Some of her threats to young Dorothy would be, you just wait till you get to the foster, the Foundling Hospital. That was a big threat. And so all your mother knew as a young girl was that must be a terrible place. And then one day when she's 5 years old, she's brought back there. And your mother, in her memoir to you, says this: we lost our individuality, our identity, our freedom, our voice, and virtually all contact with the outside world. I suppose as you look at this, it helps you make sense of the adult woman that your mother grew up to be and the kind of mother that she also was. Does it answer at least most of those questions and some of the issues related to your difficulties?
I mean, it does. And at one point, I spent time with another foundling who had been a classmate of my mother's, and I spoke to her of our difficulties, and she said to me, she said, well, of course your mother wasn't a good mother. No one had taught her how to be that, and she had never had one herself. How would she have known? And, you know, my mother was raised in an institution without love. I mean, think about it. No one loved my mother for most of her childhood. And then, you know, years later, she has a child and has to navigate how to express love. Mm. But she has no role model and no way to figure out how to do that.
You know, it occurs to me, too, that when we are thinking about what the Foundling Hospital was like, particularly at the time when your mother was there, it's important probably for us to understand that although there were probably plenty of people who were just unkind by nature, maybe the last people who should be working in a place like that, but in a sense, part of why there was this lack of affection for these foundlings is because that was, in a sense, the official moral stance of the institution. One of the rules of this place was this: foundlings should be often reminded of the lowness of their condition, that they may early imbibe the principles of humility and gratitude to their benefactors. In other words, it was a concerted effort for these young foundlings to be reminded of exactly who they were or what they were, even though, of course, who they were and what they were was of no fault of their own. But nevertheless, that was an abiding principle that guided every detail of how these foundlings were raised, that they should never forget their low station in life.
Right. And they were really dehumanized. And so, you know, society said that they were not equal and that they were not worthy of love and only there to serve. And so when that kind of environment is created, I mean, it's not surprising that those who were charged to care for them were brutal, and they saw them as less than they were and not deserving of love. So why should they love them?
Well, one of the mysteries, as far as you were concerned, was, in a sense, how did your mother grow up to be who she was? I mean, in a sense, it's no surprise at all that she was the kind of mother that she was. I mean, mm-hmm. It's actually remarkable that she was able to mother you as well as she did, for as poor a job as she did, of course. But beyond that, you wondered about who your mother ultimately became, and in particular her talents. You say at one point, "My mother's talents seemed endless to me. Other things, played the piano and had interest in the arts and was clearly intelligent." Where did all of that come from if she grew up in a place like the Foundling Hospital? And your book recounts how, in fact, there is a rich artistic legacy that is woven into the history of this institution. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, it's not going to be too surprising that the Foundling Hospital provided the inspiration for Charles Dickens. And in fact, for a time, he lived just around the corner, and he would wander through the campus, and he would go to Sunday services there, and that's where he got his inspiration for Oliver Twist and various other characters that were in his book. Handel was also a patron of the Foundling Hospital, and he created he wrote the Foundling Anthem. And the last bit of the Foundling Anthem is something I think we will all recognize, and that was the Messiah. And the Messiah was not too popular. He had tried it out. It wasn't getting much success. But then he played it. He had it performed at in the Foundling Chapel, and all of London came. And it was so successful that there was actually more shows added. And it is the reason that we listen to the Messiah. And the Foundling Hospital is the reason that it was so popular. And in fact, he deeded a copy of it, which you can see now in the Foundling Museum in London.
Amazing. And some of this, in terms of the deprivation, the terrible deprivation of your mother's childhood, helped make sense for you, among other things, of why she put you on this kind of endlessly spinning wheel of activities. You write at one point, "My mind raced to my own childhood, the endless stream of lessons and tutors. My mother had raised me in a warped, dystopian version of what she imagined a proper British upbringing to be." And of course, you always thought she herself had such an upbringing. And of course, only long after the fact learned that, in fact, her upbringing was anything but. Tell us about the emotional journey that this has represented for you. And in particular, how difficult, I'm sure, it must be to come to this new understanding of your mother and who she was and why she was the way she was, in a sense, much later than I'm sure you wish you would have come to know all of this.
Well, I took this journey for a variety of reasons. One is that when my mother died, I was overcome with grief, and I was just stunned because I had loathed her my entire life, and then here I was I was exhausted, and just it was really a surprise, and I wanted to understand why, and so I took this journey. Also, because I knew that she had had a troubled childhood by that point. She had given me enough clues. This was, she'd given me the memoir. I knew she was a foundling. And I wanted to make sense of what do you do when someone treats you badly, but they were treated badly themselves, and it's going down through the generations. Like, how do you process that? And so that was really the journey that I took. And I realized along that journey that my anger was not necessarily directed at my mother, but at myself. And that I felt that it was my fault, that somehow I was unlovable or, you know, whatever it may be, as a young child thinks. And I think this is common in families where there's some sort of abuse that the child somehow takes that on themselves. And I came to realize that it wasn't my fault. And it wasn't my mother's fault either, but that we were in a piece of history that tore families apart, and that those decisions were made all the way back in the 1700s impacted my childhood home.
And I appreciate the fact that you not only come to this new understanding of your mother, but also come away with a profound respect for your grandmother, Lena Weston. And you know, at one point you say that you have taken tremendous pride in yourself as sort of a trailblazer, as an environmental attorney who has achieved great renown. But then you are humbled when you think about what your grandmother had to face, and you realize that the feather in your cap was won so easily and with so little personal cost compared to what your grandmother faced. This book is just staggering in its personal honesty, and I find it just beautiful from end to end, even in the pages that are painful. In our last minute or so, could you just explain to our listeners how the new printing gives still more information about your mother and grandmother?
Well, after the book was published, it was initially published in hardcover last year in January, and there was a piece in the New York Times about it. And shortly after that, I received a phone call, and it was from someone that knew my mother. And I could immediately tell that it was a foundling, and they knew each other at the Foundling Hospital, but also throughout my mother's life, and she had shared many details of what had happened to my mother after she left the Foundling Hospital, which is something that I was not able to uncover during my first round of research. And then after that, some genealogists reached out to me, and they had some amateur genealogists that had done some research and uncovered some other clues. And I mean, it was really astonishing. I thought the journey was over, and I had discovered everything that I was going to discover, but then there was even more. And I'm not going to go into what it is because there are a few spoilers there. I feel now that the journey for me has come to an end. There are a few questions here and there that are unanswered, but I think I understand what happened to our family now. And you know, it was a tragedy. And, you know, I carried this extreme anger towards my mother for most of my life, and now it's sadness.
Well, we appreciate you taking us on that journey with you, so to speak, in this remarkable book, which is also your first book. It is called, again, yes, The Secret Life of Dorothy Soames. It's published by Harper, the author Justine Cowan. Justine Cowan, I thank you so much for sharing this important story with us, and I thank you so much for being generous with your time and being part of the morning show today. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm excited to share an interview with you that I recorded with a most talented writer from New York City named Sadiq Fafana. who is a gifted writer and also a high school teacher, and he is coming to Carthage College next week as a visiting writer. His much-anticipated book is called Stories from the Tenants Downstairs, and you'll hear my conversation with him on tomorrow's morning show. That conversation also includes some comments from Cameron Swallow, who has helped arrange some of the community events in which